From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is The Conversation. This is a limited series featuring new voices with their own take on our city and culture. This is all made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
We may have our divisions, and we do, not this group particularly, but we do disagree with setting the time certain. There is some disagreement in the Democratic Party. The thing I'd like to remark to you all and point out, the Republicans are totally united in a failed policy.
Senator Joe Biden of Delaware says he's not worried. It's The Conversation on WNYC. I'm David Cruz. Hi again, everybody. Two separate measures calling for a U.S. pullout of Iraq went down to defeat in the Senate today, highlighting not only deep divisions in the Senate itself, but deep divisions among Democrats. Maybe you read the Times piece today about how the Republicans are reclaiming the war as an issue that works for them. The conversation tonight, why can't the Democrats come up with a coherent strategy on Iraq? With poll numbers showing overwhelming opposition to the war, have the Democrats blown their chance to prove that they can offer a viable alternative? What should the Democratic strategy be when it comes to calling for troop withdrawal? And what does that strategy have to do with the upcoming midterm elections? We're joined by Jonathan Tessini, Democratic contender for Hillary Clinton's Senate seat in New York, and Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of The New Republic. Gentlemen, welcome to The Conversation.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to be with you.
We want to take your calls on this, too. Do you have a strategy suggestion for the Democrats? The number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also use our sidebar tool where you can ask questions, rate others' questions, and answer questions, too. Just go to the website at WNYC.org. The president's ratings are in the dumps, and Americans are clearly frustrated with the war in Iraq. So why haven't the Democrats been able to take advantage of this, Peter?
You know, it's partly just the structure of our political system. We're not a parliamentary system where you have a prime minister in waiting who represents the opposition. You have a lot of people running for president. You have a Democratic leader in the House and Senate. You have a chairman of the Democratic National Committee. It's really impossible to expect that everyone is going to get on the same page. I think that what the Democrats, timetable for withdrawal is a mistake, because I think ultimately our only hope in Iraq is to try to support this new government in whatever way we can. It is a democratically elected government that is really trying to bring the three communities together. And I think by setting a firm timetable for withdrawal, we actually undermine the government when really that's our only hope for success in Iraq.
Jonathan, have the Dems shown any leadership on Iraq?
No, they have not, and I think it's actually emblematic of the Democratic Party in general, and I've been one of the skeptics on my own blog and publicly predicting the Democrats will not do very well in the elections, as they predict, because people, if they have a choice between voting for Republicans or Republican light, will always vote for the same thing, or they certainly won't vote for a party that rests its entire potential success on we're not the other guys, and they're corrupt. So I think the Democrats have shown no leadership, and with all due respect to Peter, I disagree. I think that the real strategy is something that Jim McGovern has put out, Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, who is calling in his legislation for an immediate cutoff of all funding for offensive actions in Iraq and allowing only for money to be spent for immediate safe withdrawal of the troops, reconstruction of Iraq, and money to replace the U.S. military with an international security force. Every single day that the U.S. military is there, the insurgency grows, and there's no chance to heal Iraq.
Can I ask a question about that?
Go right ahead, Peter.
What do you think will happen once we do that?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge two things. I think you and I would agree that it's a disastrous situation in Iraq, and that we created that by essentially destroying another country. I can't promise you 100% that we will have a stable Iraq after we withdraw in the way I described, but I am absolutely convinced that every single day the U.S. military stays there, the situation gets worse, not better. I lived in that area for 7 years back in the 1970s, so I'm a little bit familiar with the geopolitical situation, and I believe that, for example, example, Pakistan, Jordan, and Egypt have a great desire to see a stable Iraq for their own internal political reasons. They're essentially dictatorships.
Do you think they'll send in troops if we leave?
Let me just finish. They're essentially dictatorships. They do not want to see the al-Qaeda elements and so on become stronger. I believe that the only reason they will not participate now in international security force, which is what I believe is the only chance to have stability there, is because of the U.S. presence. They do not want to be stained by the United States.
You think they'll go in?
If we left, they would step in?
I believe
so. Have they said anything like that?
I believe that both that there's a chance that they would participate and or a combination of the UN and NATO, because people do want a stable Iraq. The reason we don't have a real international coalition is because of the United States. No one wants to hold hands with the United States in that region, because to do so stains you. That's pretty clear.
You think that's true, Peter?
You know, I wish that what Mr. Cassini were true. I really do. But I think what's important to remember is that the Iraqi government does not take the position that he takes. I mean, the Iraqi government, it seems to me, is the one, more than anyone else, who recognizes how we delegitimize it, but who still believes that its best chance for success, in fact, its only chance for success, is for us to stick around a while longer so it can defend itself against this insurgency while it tries to rewrite the Constitution to bring the Sunnis into the political process and to work against these militias. And I think, I would love to believe that Pakistan and Egypt, in fact, would get involved and send in their own troops into Iraq. But I think the reality is, and we saw this time and time again, we saw this in the Balkans, for instance, that when America is not involved, the rest of the world doesn't act at all. I have no confidence whatsoever. In fact, I think it's remarkably far-fetched to think that the Europeans, who are not willing to go in now while America would protect them, are going to send in the Belgian and the Scandinavian militaries into Iraq after we've left with the absolute chaos. This government might fall the day after we left. I think it's crazy to think they would step in.
It's interesting because everything that is far-fetched has been every prediction every 3 months by the people who have supported the United States involvement in Iraq, whether it be Thomas Friedman or Rumsfeld or, frankly, Hillary Clinton. Every 3 months or 6 months they're saying, we're about to turn the corner. If we just had these elections, we'll turn the corner. If we just had this, we'll turn the corner. It won't work. And it's a fantasy, a fallacy, and it's going to cause more death and destruction, more lives lost, both Americans and Iraqis, if we stay there one day longer.
You're listening to The Conversation on AM 820 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm David Cruz. We're talking with Jonathan Tassini and Peter Beinart about the Democrats and their inability to unite behind a message on Iraq. Let's get to a phone call here. This is Jesse from Brooklyn. Jesse, welcome to The Conversation.
Hi, how you doing? I'd like to comment on what Democrats need to do. They need to unite behind one issue, and I think that issue should be the protection of civil liberties. Civil liberties have been eroded for a long time, even under Clinton.
You think that's the issue they need to unite behind in Iraq?
I think that's what Democrats need to unite behind, period. I think that it has an overarching effect on just about every policy, whether domestic or foreign, in this country. And civil liberties have been eroded for a long time, but at an especially rapid rate under the Bush regime.
How do you think, Jesse, that kind of message plays in the red states?
Lots of concerned people in the red states, too, about civil liberties as well.
Yep. I agree with Jesse. I agree on the narrow point.
Thanks for your call, Jesse.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Peter.
It's Jonathan.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. Go ahead.
No problem. I think he has a point, which is I think that civil liberties, and if you look at the people who united around the wiretapping, the NSA wiretapping, they actually spanned the traditional spectrum of left and right. There are many organizations that there was a lot of furor about that. There are many people who were concerned about renewal of the Patriot Act specific provisions. But I would say I'm not sure that that's the thing that galvanizes the American people and brings the Democrats into power.
I also think the erosion of civil liberties has been a very serious issue, but you have to look at why civil liberties eroded even under Bill Clinton. They started eroding under Bill Clinton because of Oklahoma City, and then they eroded after 9/11 partly because of the terrible things the Bush administration did, but because we were attacked. The struggle for civil liberties in this country is also the struggle for security. Unless Democrats have a vision for how they're going to win the war on terror, civil liberties will always be imperiled, because countries that feel unsafe are not countries that protect civil liberties.
But the war on terror is an endless concept.
The Cold War was not an endless concept. It's a
fantasy.
All right, one at a time, guys.
Go ahead, David. I'm sorry. Did you want to say this, David?
Well, no, I just wanted to make sure you talked, you know, one at a time.
Sure.
Let me just ask a question here.
Yeah.
What's the effect of today's vote on how Americans see the Democrats on this issue?
Peter, go ahead.
I think ultimately, in the long run, it's not going to make a big difference. I actually think midterm elections are generally referendums on the incumbents. You know, everyone talks about the Contract for America in 1994. The reality is, at best, 10% of the voters in 1994 even knew what the Contract for America was. People will be voting as a referendum on George W. Bush and the Republican Congress. But in 2008, that's when it's going to be absolutely critical for Democrats to have a vision for where we are in Iraq at that point, but more generally for how to make America safe and how to create a better world. And I think that's the test that John Kerry failed, and it's what the next Democrat needs to be able to do.
John, you think there's no net effect negatively on the Democrats after a vote like today?
Oh, I think that it depends on specific races. I think overall nationally, the Democrats will look to be seen as not having a particularly coherent idea and, frankly, being afraid. I think that the problem has been that the whole discussion has been done in a very, very narrow framework of either you cut and run, or if you want to be patriotic, you don't withdraw, and it's sort of either the Kerry position or the Levin-Reed Amendment. Whereas I think if you actually had some courage in the Democratic Party and you said this war was wrong, it was immoral, we have to leave now, I think that would say something different to the American people. But I don't think the Democratic Party is there. I don't think they have much spine, either on this issue or, frankly, on domestic and other foreign policy issues.
Where's the split in the Democratic Party? Peter?
Well, there are a number of splits. I think on Iraq, the split is fundamentally about people who believe that it's hopeless in Iraq and people who believe that there's still hope in Iraq. I think most of the people who say that withdrawal from Iraq, in fact, is our best chance to defeat the insurgency and stabilize the country, I mostly think they are people who've just given up in Iraq. And I accept that there may be an argument, in fact, that there's nothing more we can do in Iraq. But what I'm struck by is the fact that that's not the position of the Iraqi government. Let's remember what happened there. We invaded that country. They didn't ask to be invaded. We turned the government completely upside down. We told the people to vote. They risked their lives to vote. You know, a lot of Americans don't go 10 minutes down the street to vote. These guys would risk their lives to vote in very large numbers. They elected a government that is trying to bring all three communities together. All three communities voted. And now we're going to tell that government, see ya, we're sick of it, goodbye. I don't think that's America. I think it's a question of national honor. We don't do that as a country.
Well, whom are we trying to restore hope? The Iraqis, the United States, or the Democrats?
Because if that government falls, it is the deluge in Iraq. The consequences of that government falling and the country splitting into civil war and the Sunni area becoming a safe haven for insurgents who menace the whole region, not to mention Europe, is a prospect too terrifying to contemplate.
Let's understand this, David. The reality is that it's not about the people who believe in immediate withdrawal or don't agree or don't believe that that there's no hope and that we haven't given up. It's that we have a different vision about where the country can go and where hope lies. I, again, repeat, I believe that every day the United States military is there. Even one boot on the ground, the insurgency will continue and grow. We cannot be there militarily. We are not going to help this country. And I'm actually optimistic, but the only way I believe that there would be a chance for Iraq to recover and heal itself is for the United States to withdraw immediately.
All right. Ted is in New York. He says no Democratic plan is going to pass so long as the Republicans are in power. They're providing alternatives, and that's what's important. No? Are they really providing alternatives?
The Democrats or the Republicans? I didn't understand.
Democrats.
Well,
he says so long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate, that the Democrats really can't do anything.
Well, I think that's a legitimate point. But the question is, if you're trying to offer an alternative in order to take back the Congress and to try to shift the direction of the country, my view is that the alternatives offered don't offer enough distinction with the Republicans, or at the very least, the Democratic Party seems fairly weak. And one of the things that's concerned me throughout this campaign, I've been campaigning 6 months, and I think this has been true for a very long time, is all the Republicans have to do is yell the words patriotism, and you're not supporting the troops, and the Democrats run for cover. There seems to be a need to mouth the empty slogan, support the troops, or walk around and wear lapel flags in your lapel, rather than say, we are patriotic, but we believe that our country should not attack countries that pose no threat to us, and we believe that this has been a failed mission, and we have to leave now. It takes courage to admit you made a mistake. And I think in some way, for some of those politicians, including Hillary Clinton, who voted for the war and whose position has been no different in many ways than the administration, I think that's very difficult to admit they made a mistake.
We can. We want to remind you can use our sidebar tool where you can ask questions, rate others' questions, and answer questions. In fact, that's where Ted from New York City checked in. Just go to the website at WNYC.org and click on the sidebar tool. I wonder if both of you might have read that piece in the Times today where they talked about how the Republicans have sort of reclaimed this issue to their great advantage. And they talked about how, you know, the Republicans have unleashed Karl Rove. Do the Democrats need their own Karl Rove?
You can't have a Karl Rove when you don't have the White House. Again, because we don't have a political system.
Well, someone to function in that capacity in terms of leading the message.
Well, the problem is that you can't control people who want to run for president because you don't control their money. For the last, you know, John Kerry or these other guys are raising their own money for president. There's no one who has the leverage to tell them that not to go and put forth the amendments they want to put forth. I think the larger challenge for the Democratic Party is to start now in having the debate. I think the debate that Jonathan and I are having, actually, about what the larger, this is what my book, The Good Fight, is about the larger vision that the Democratic Party has about how we create a safer, better world. I think that starts with Iraq, but it goes much beyond Iraq. And we have to start having that debate now, so I think that we get a better message out by 2008 than John Kerry was able to do in 2004, where he basically just said, I'm not George W. Bush, and I served in Vietnam.
Well, I don't disagree with Peter at all. I think John Kerry, the famous, I voted for the whatever $1 billion before I voted against it. He was, if one thing John Kerry promoted himself was as a military hero, he did not have a clear message about what his position was about the war. Neither did Wesley Clark, and I think he stumbled out of the gate. He couldn't answer what his position about Iraq was. But on your point to the Republicans, you know, I'm not so convinced that this is going to have a lot of legs, putting Karl Rove out there in the security issue again. I'm one who believes that they may have overplayed their hand once too many. The whole killing of Zarqawi, for instance, I think was a 2 or 3 day story that gave them a little bump and a little more support and rallied people. But overall, I think there's such disdain and disgust for the war, and that's mounting. I'm not sure that even Karl Rove can turn that around.
All right. Jonathan Tessini is running for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate from New York. And Peter Beinart is editor-at-large of The New Republic. Thank you both for being a part of the conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Later on the show, we'll check out how the rock and Espanol scene is in the city. But up next, the shrinking influence of New York's Puerto Rican community. It's The Conversation on WNYC. Back in a minute. Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm David Cruz. Puerto Rican pride was very much in evidence at the Puerto Rican Day Parade just a couple of weeks ago here in New York City. And a new documentary by Rosie Perez, Soy Boricua, is airing this month on the Sundance Channel. So you might think that this is a good time to be Puerto Rican in New York. But a recent op-ed piece in the New York Post suggests that Boricuas are disappearing from the conversation in New York. Has it really come to this? Can a million Puerto Ricans in New York really be irrelevant? Joining us to talk about this is the author of that op-ed piece, poet, activist, and one of the founders of the Young Lords Party, Felipe Luciano, and Gerson Borrero, columnist for El Diario and political commentator for New York One. Señores, welcome to The Conversation.
Buenas noches.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Felipe, you wrote, "Today, we," meaning Puerto Ricans, "are fading out of sight, insignificant in the true power circles of New York City. There are leaders, yes, but they've been so enveloped in the institutions that they're indistinguishable from the bland and arrogant status quo. No militancy, no vision, no plan or platform, no intelligence." That's pretty harsh, man.
It is, and sometimes as critics, as advocates, as lovers of our culture, we have to be realistic and we have to be straight up with regard to how we view our community. The National Puerto Rican Coalition said in a recent paper, the economic attainment of the stateside community, meaning Puerto Ricans, continues to lag behind the general population as well as other Hispanic populations. The proportion of U.S. Puerto Ricans in poverty has changed little in the last 20 years. Those last 20 years are the same last 20 years that some of our caciques, some of our Puerto Rican politicians, have been in power. Now, when you realize that the Latino dropout rate is about 26% of all Hispanic students in this city who drop out of high school, when you realize that Puerto Ricans have had a deterioration in the neighborhoods and that the mean educational attainment of Puerto Ricans is less than high school graduation, we have to look at why this is happening. We have poor quality of education. We're not doing well with regard to that. High dropout rate among Hispanic public school students. When you look at what the United States Census says, when you look at Puerto Ricans, who are 2.4 million in this country, they represent about 27 years median age. The percentage of families living in poverty is 36%.
So, Garcon, the numbers are bad. Is it that bad?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You can always do many things with numbers, especially when it involves a nonprofit institution who benefits from these kind of circumstances that keep them in business. They're able to get funding. They're able to get all kinds of grants. They're able to do all kinds of studies to continue doing studies about the problems they're not a solution for. So it's great that Felipe is citing that. I don't dispute that those figures are bad, but we can take a look at many communities and do the same. You know, it sounds, when you read what Felipe wrote, which he's entitled to his opinion, and once in a while, there's got to be a bomb thrower. And in this case, with his prose, with his words, Felipe threw a bomb that has had reaction. It has repercussions. It's reverberated throughout the community. But it sounds like he's talking about either the Democrat or Republican Party, just what you said. And it could describe any given group, any particular ethnic group or political group in the United States. I find it interesting that you opened up the show, which I appreciated, a modern version of Rafael Hernandez's Lamento Borincano.
Right.
Puerto Ricans have been lamenting our situation for a long time. I think we're in great shape. It's not as dire and as pessimistic as Felipe sees it. I think it bears some of his own personal frustration in terms of when he's tried to make a difference and he has made many contributions, when he locks horns with the political elite of our community. And I think that's what he's really talking about. I don't know of any other community in the United States, and if you know one, please, that can pull out 2 million people on a given Sunday in June and have them be present with pride and demonstrating their culture. If that's diminishing power, then you show me the equivalent of that of any group in the United States.
But that's a parade. Let me just jump in here and say, you're listening to The Conversation on AM 820 WNYC and WNYC.org. We want to get you in on the conversation. Puerto Ricans, what do you think? Were you better off in the 70s, or have you just moved to another level? Give us a call. The number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also use our sidebar tool where you can ask questions, rate others' questions, and answer these questions. Just go to the website at WNYC.org and click on the toolbar there, the conversation toolbar. Let's see here. Garcon, you talked about the 2 million people who were at the parade this week, but, I mean, that's a parade. You know, I think one of the criticisms of the Puerto Rican community frequently is that we're all about the party. And I'm not talking about a political party. I'm talking about the party. And you get people to show up 2 million strong for the Puerto Rican Day Parade. But in other instances, Puerto Ricans are frequently silent and underrepresented.
Well, I've been a critic of the parade and much of what is done there and what happens with it. And that we go back, and certainly Felipe has a history from the Young Lords when they had to crash the parade in order to get in. It's important to show that physical presence on Fifth Avenue. Also remember, as weak as it may be, and it's only one day, it's been happening next year for 50 continuous years. That shows a staying power. We have elected officials. They may not be to the liking of people like Felipe who don't see it moving fast enough, and sometimes I'm very disappointed. But, you know, in 2005, for the first time in this city, a city who has had 108 mayors, only one black mayor, we got close to the mayoralty by having a nominee of one of the major parties, this time being the Democrats, to be able to be the official nominee of that party. I think that shows some kind of staying power.
Let's talk a little bit about that. When Freddie Frere got beat so badly last November, I remember thinking, well, that's the last Puerto Rican you're going to see running for mayor of New York for another decade.
Jesus Christ would have been beaten by Michael Bloomberg if he came down to run against him against those millions of dollars, almost $100 million that he spent. Jesus Christ would have lost the election.
Felipe?
If I may add a point here, the parade is form. It is not substance. Let's look at the macroeconomic structure of New York. How many Puerto Rican financial institutions do you see? The indices for success in this country are educational attainment, acquisition of wealth, savings, home ownership, stability of family. On all of those, we are failing miserably. Now, for us to look at the parade and use that as a substitute for real power, we are hurting ourselves, we're deluding ourselves, which is why we started the Young Lords in the first place. Did I not like the fact I ran for councilman twice, and her son is absolutely right. It was frustrating not being able to get in, but that is not any reason. I think I'm intellectual enough. I think most of us understand that there's a difference between personal and collective responsibility. We have a problem here. We don't see superstores. We don't have any stores. In El Barrio, just give you an example, we have five Puerto Rican areas that were formerly very productive in terms of bodegueros, in terms of movie houses, in terms of micro institutions of economic power. Park Slope was one, Williamsburg was another, we had the Lower East Side, we had the Bronx, we have a few of them, we had El Barrio. Each of those areas of local economic concentration has been diminished. In East Harlem, there's not one movie house that we have. We don't have one quality clothing store. We have a gym that just opened up, a private gym. We are hurting badly, and it's because we have a system of microeconomics that isn't even working. On macroeconomic sense, compared to other Latinos, compared to Dominicans, compared, God bless them, compared to Colombians, compared to Central Americans, in the Census Bureau, and this is demographic, socio-demographic information that was compiled by the United States Bureau of the Census.
All right, Gerson, Felipe makes a good point,
Let me finish this point. The Central and South Americans have 24% people living in poverty. We have 36%. Our families making less than $25,000 a year. We have 58% living on less than $25,000 a year. Central and South Americans who have less education have 49%. That has to do with their economic sense of attainment.
All right, I got your point. I got your point, Felipe. Gerson?
David, before we start handing out the cyanide pill so we can mask suicide, let me just point out the following. What Felipe doesn't take into account is that those people that came here from Central South America and some parts of the Caribbean and with regard to the Dominican Republic, remember, they come here without the kind of political limbo that we have in Puerto Rico. We are a commonwealth, a possession in this day and age of the United States who invaded our country and has maintained us, imposed on us a citizenship that we never were asked whether we wanted it or not. We're not an independent nation. The people that he spoke about are for the cream of the crop, the cream of the intelligence that don't see an opportunity in the countries that he mentioned, and they come here with money, they come here with education. It is not the same kind of people that came from Puerto Rico to establish a colony outside the colony, that is a presence in this city. Felipe, you're being very unfair. You're comparing origins with tigers. It isn't the same thing. And you know it.
All right. Number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. I want to ask this question without offending too much, but have Puerto Ricans really settled for political crumbs? I mean, deputy commissioner seats and ethnic-specific jobs in government and industry as opposed to other ethnic or racial groups who maybe demand more. Have you seen that, Felipe?
I think that we have within us a cultural attribute which avoids confrontation. I think in the main, I see this in Puerto Rico, I see this here. We would rather die than offend people. And in doing so, we've not been able to establish a political beachhead. We don't, as they say on the street, step up to people, even our own leadership. We have to step up. We have to confront. We have to put the fingers in their face. And we have to collectivize rather than criticize, collectivize and begin to put that strength together. For example, I can criticize, but I would do anything to keep anybody from hurting Gerson, from hurting Jose Rivera, from hurting Roberto Ramirez, hurting Carrion or Ferrer. The point that we're trying to make is that we get so busy. We have a saying among Puerto Ricans about the huellas. One gets to the top, the other pulls him down. That is not the way to increase our macroeconomics. That is not the way to increase our political power. I think that the only way, and I'm convinced of this because I saw this happen in the 60s, we are going to have to change our system of morality. Our morality has to be a lot more aggressive, a lot more militant, a lot more in your face. We consider that, and even in our own culture, we say, that's a little, eso son los negros, the blacks do that. They do that. Other people do that. We have not learned yet that it is not a parade that makes for power. It's stability of power, it's acquisition of wealth, it's educational attainment. Education has to become as much of a mantra as being Puerto Rican. It has to be synonymous with being Puerto Rican.
Okay, Jorge is in Brooklyn. Jorge, welcome to the conversation. Very well, thank you.
I feel touched a little bit because one of your guests said that you're comparing apples to tigers, that we come from with lots of money to here. Yes, we have education because we have no other choice. We have to work really hard and establish ourselves.
Jorge, you're Venezuelano, no? You're from Venezuela?
Yes, sir, and I came with $100 because I had nothing else. And I had to work really hard, and I didn't depend on welfare and all those kind of helps that Puerto Ricans are entitled to, and they have to show that they have less income, so they're entitled to welfare. So I feel really offended with those things.
Okay,
they have it too easy.
Jorge, thank you for your phone call. Guys, what do you think?
Well, I think
that's not the first time we've heard that about Puerto Ricans, right?
That happens is that, and I get tired of Puerto Rican victimization. I don't know where we got this from, but in Puerto Rico, if you're guilty, you're guilty.
Right.
We have to stop saying que nosotros somos víctimas. What the gentleman who just came on the air said is, look, I came here with $100, I worked. Now, one of the problems in our work ethic, and we had it, there's no doubt that Puerto Ricans can work, is the stabilization of family. And we need our families to come together. We need to stop the male-female war that's going on among Puerto Ricans in this city is atrocious. All of us have participated in it. I am certainly not an example, and I would not put myself up as a paragon of family virtue. But I do tell you this. I've realized at this late stage of the game that my children have to be imbued with concepts of leadership, of fatherhood, of motherhood, and educational attainment. That is absolutely important, regardless of whether or not we are with their mothers or fathers. That is very important.
Gerson?
David, the person who called, the gentleman, the Venezuelan who called, I didn't want to be offended. I'm the one. Gerson Borrero was the one that said that he's comparing apples to tigers or oranges to tigers, whatever you want to take it. The fact that is that as a Venezolano, he came here because he had no other options. I'm saying that Puerto Rico, because of its colonial status, the political status and the limbo that we live in, we are given too many options, but I do believe that he's wrong. Nothing is given to Puerto Ricans. We've given up our soil. We have been inundated by a foreign invasion of the U.S. troops starting in 1898. Our land has been taken. It's been polluted. It's been exploited. Do you understand that, sir? Understand that we have nothing. You can someday hope to go back to a country without whoever it is that's in power.
Gerson, let me get Miriam in here. Miriam is calling from Brooklyn. Miriam, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Felipe, buenas tardes.
How are you?
I'm calling because I'm of Puerto Rican descent, and I'm very offended that that other gentleman from Venezuela has said that a lot of Puerto Ricans took advantage of public assistance programs. My father joined the Union when he came here from Puerto Rico in 1950, a lot of his brothers and his sisters also. I'm educated. I have a bachelor's degree.
Right.
I've seen a lot of Puerto Rican Americans who have joined white American companies and are earning good salaries right now. We're not dependent dependent on those programs. Now, the problem is that ever since this federal administration has changed, a lot of programs have changed, a lot of things have been going towards people who have money. And to your other guests, the people who have money are not necessarily from South America. They're coming to this,
all right, Miriam,
this other, to the city and building things that we cannot afford because we don't have the six-figure incomes that are going to those individuals earning that income.
All right, Miriam, thank you for your call. We're going to have to leave it there. Felipe Luciano and Gerson Borrero, thanks for being a part of the conversation.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Up next, El Rock en Español. Stay tuned.
We have right now Cultura Etílica. They're playing right now in upstairs. They're living in Jersey, but they're from Peru and different countries.
I like Spanish rock, but there's a band called Héroes del Silencio, Soda Stereo. Caifán is from Mexico, yeah, because I am from Mexico, so I love them.
They rock it. They talk to the crowd. They get the crowd pumping. That's what you need. You need
outrageous mini marsh pit in a bar. Tell me how. Marsh pit broke out. Woo!
Dude, it was a total mosh pit. Those folks were out partying at AlternaFest, a battle of the band style music festival featuring the best Latin alternative rock in the tri-state area. Leo Arciniegas is one of the organizers of the festival. Leo, welcome to the conversation. Leo, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Welcome. The folks out at the club the other night were kids in their early 20s and 30s. Are these kids listening to salsa or to Green Day?
Well, it's actually kind of funny because the days of the traditional Spanish, rhythms such as merengue and salsa, those days have been shifting, especially in the later years, with the whole movement of reggaeton, especially very hot now, and obviously with the whole movement of rock en español as well.
Let me have your thoughts on reggaeton, because for me, reggaeton is to me the bird flu of music.
Yeah, well, in a way, I mean, it's been growing tremendously in the last couple of years. I mean, we've seen, especially here in New York, we've seen how one radio station, which was back then Latino Mix 105.9, basically changed their format to suit the reggaeton style of music. Unfortunately, Latino Mix was the only radio station that supported Spanish rock, rock en español, and due to that recent change in format, we had to create different things, but it seems like, you know, all of the indicators are there to support the reggaetonist movement.
I'm thinking of the Mexican band El Gran Silencio. They're one of the big acts in rock en español today. Besides the lyric being in español, what about this band makes them Latin?
Well, this band makes a very Latin, especially, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to listen to them, but they're very, you know, the different rhythms and the different instruments that they use, they're very Mexican-oriented, which they mix in traditional cumbia sounds with rock en español, and that makes it very appealing to the different communities within the Hispanic community. For instance, I'm particularly Colombian, and I enjoy listening to El Gran Silencio because it reminds me of some of the music that I used to hear back home in Colombia.
All right, let's listen to a little bit of El Gran Silencio. While I tell you, you can use our sidebar tool at WNYC.org if you want to get in on the conversation. Ask a question, rate a question, answer a question at the sidebar tool.
Hip hop desde Nuevo León con el corazón. Escucha lo que digo cuando tomo el micrófono. Así que ponme atención. Lo que entra por tus oídos es una buena combinación.
One now con el ritmo original. Original flow ragamuffin style. My people, fly baby. Shalom, shalom, Dora Mercy. Bye bye.
Never shut the mouth. Never shut the mouth. Never shut the mouth. Never shut the mouth.
En la puerta casa no escucha ragamuffin, mira. En el comedo todos quieren ragamuffin, mira. En Guadalupe solo piden ragamuffin, mira. Y todo el mundo con las manos para arriba. San Nicolás solo quiere ragamuffin, mira. En Monterrey siempre suena ragamuffin, mira. Santa Catarina como quiere ragamuffin, mira. Y todo el mundo con las manos para arriba. arriba.
Y una vez más, sigo por aquí, sigo con el beat, rimando en el sonido del comando.
It's a little bit of El Gran Silencio. You can check in with us via the sidebar tool on the website at WNYC.org. Just go to the site and click on the sidebar tool. Tom is doing just that. He's in the West Village. He says, Spanish rock is always 10 years behind American and British rock. Where are the Spanish bands that are innovating an original sound? What do you think of that, Leo?
Well, I think that it's slowly catching on. I mean, as you mentioned, some of these Spanish rock bands have been influenced by American music. But in a way, I do agree with you that they're maybe, I wouldn't say 10 years behind, but I'm thinking maybe up to five years behind. I think that back in the 80s, you see a huge movement, especially in Latin American countries, with groups such as Jaguares, such as Soda Stereo, such as Héroes del Silencio. They had kind of paved the way for a lot of, you know, some of the new and upcoming bands, such as Juanes, and some of the more popular, more mainstream bands, like La Oreja de Van Gogh and some of the other well-known bands like Maná.
Let's talk a little bit about Juanes. Probably when you ask 8 out of 10 people, they'll tell you that the Latin rock or the Spanish rock that they know most is Juanes, who had a big crossover hit last year, the year before that. What about Juanes? What impact does Juanes have on Spanish rock across the country?
I think that Juanes is more a mainstream product. I think that he definitely has a lot of influences. And back when he was part of another band, you know, that's when he was really a Spanish, true, you know, Spanish rock star.
Right.
I think that, you know, the way that, unfortunately, due to the marketing and the promotion and, you know, the fact that, you know, the media is looking for something more promotional driven, I think that that made him change a little bit. And that's the Juanes that we see here. Luckily, he still has a lot of roots back to Colombia. So he still plays a lot of the traditional Huasca music, which is very traditional from Colombia. And he's very popish in a way. He's in the border of mainstream Spanish rock and, you know, and rock en español.
All right, let's hear a little bit of Juanes.
Sure.
Voy a hacerlo intenso. Hoy puede apagarse el sol. Pero no, la luz de mi alma. Caminaré más despacio en un día como hoy. Defenderé mi verdad en un día como hoy. Te amarraré con mis brazos en un día como hoy. Porque nunca sabes lo que tienes.
Okay, there's some Juanes, but maybe you heard Juanes on the radio, but especially now that Latino Mix is gone, you don't really hear any Latin rock or Spanish language rock on the radio. Does that concern you as a promoter, Leo?
That is correct. I mean, the only station that we have here that closely would play a Maná or a Jaguares or a Juanes song would be Amor 93.1.
Mm.
It does concern me because I think for any movement, you really depend on the media to help you support it. Obviously, it's a very underground movement, and we've been very lucky in packing up the places where we have alternatives. But at the same time, I think that when you look at other traditional rhythms, such as reggaeton, it's been a hit because reggaeton started back in the 80s with, you know, artists like Vico C. But until it started getting airplay on some of these radio stations, that's when it really started taking off. I think that there's a public there for Spanish rock, rock en español. But at the same time, you have to really expose them to the unique sounds of it. And unless you have, you know, traditional or non-traditional media to help you support that, you're not going to really grow this movement overnight. It's going to take some years.
Is there an English language market for rock en español?
I think, and it was kind of funny, but I was talking about this, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I think that the rhythm, the sounds are very similar. I mean, besides taking the lyrics away, which obviously are in Spanish, but if you take the lyrics away, I mean, you could not tell whether it's American rock or Latin rock. And those are some of the benefits that you would not be able to do with, let's say, salsa. Salsa does not resemble to any type of American music. And that's one of the advantages that Rock en Español has. It really closely resembles American rock, and I think that both have been influenced by one to the other.
Now, we have another post on the sidebar here. The question is, Rock en Español is badly labeled, if you ask me. Actually, that's a statement. A great contemporary rock group like the former Rage Against the Machine is Spanish in many ways, with lead vocals like Zach de la Rocha.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
You'll be amazed, but groups like, you know, if you want to talk about Rock en Español, and that's one of the reasons why in our Battle of the Bands, we divided the categories because there are so many sub rhythms in Rock en Español. You have hard rock, you have ska, you have the traditional alternative rock, you have rock negro, rock pesado. So there's different categories that you have that, and going back to Rage Against the Machine, you'll find that a lot of these American rock bands, they have been influenced by Hispanics, basically musicians that have either they have been born outside the U.S. or have had their parents' heritage from a Latin American country.
All right, how about real quickly what some of the bands are in New York and New Jersey that are making some noise?
Yeah, actually, last year's winner of Alternafest, Cofre, is really, up and coming. Bands like Vertigo, they just signed a record deal with Sony BMG and a label called Avalon Records. It's really up and coming. You also have a number of bands such as Lopez out of New Jersey. You also have Silueta Ville. You also have Orbita. You have groups like Pistolera that is very close to El Gran Silencio, and they're also participating in Alternafest. So there's so many of them. I mean, this year, and one of the reasons we expanded this year Alternafest, because last year we only have 12 participating bands. This year we needed to open it up to 28 because we received about 110 demos.
All right, Leo, I'm going to need to leave it there. Leo Arciniegas is the organizer of Alternafest. The Fest. Leo, thanks for being a part of the conversation.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the support.
Up next, searching for celebs in New York. We're going to go out with a little Gran Silencio. This is The Conversation on WNYC. Never shock them on.
How do I avoid running into tourists everywhere I go?
How do I get my mom to buy me a PSP?
Learn how to knit left-handed.
How do I act like I'm not a tourist?
How do I make an airplane? Because I love flying.
Yes, it's time to play How Do I? It's our regular exercise where you try to stump our producers by asking them a question you'd really like to have answered. Just go to WNYC.org, click on the conversation to send us your How Do I question through the sidebar tool. Tonight, our question is, how do I spot celebrities? Celebrities are, of course, all around us. This is New York, after all. But for most of us, we see a lot more of them in the supermarket checkout than walking around in Manhattan. So let's find out now how to make sure we never miss a famous face. Joining us is Lawrence Lussier, a freelance photographer and frequent contributor to People, Us Weekly, and In Touch magazine. Lawrence, welcome to the conversation.
Hey, thank you very much.
So what's your best strategy if you're an average Joe or Jane who wants to spot more famous people?
Well, I would guess, if you're a regular Joe in New York City, the best option would be to visit a taping of a regularly scheduled television show in Manhattan.
So how do you find out about that?
Well, it's very simple. All the shows have websites, and the schedules change daily, but you can also write to them in advance and request tickets. And at some point, you'll receive tickets in the mail. Whether or not you can make it on that date is up to you.
You're working right now, right? Where are you?
Oh, well, I'm on Little West 12th Street in the Meatpacking District outside a nightclub.
What's happening there?
Christina Aguilera is about to walk in the door, and everyone's very...
All right, so everybody should go there now and check out Christina Aguilera, right?
Well, you know, you would see her, probably. That's right.
So is there a best neighborhood to hang out in? Is it the Meatpacking District?
This is the Meatpacking District. That's best for nightclubs and some shopping, but probably the best neighborhood is Soho.
is Soho to catch stars.
That's right.
Any particular day of the week, time of the day?
Well, certainly. I think in general the weekends are the best to catch stars in Soho because they're shopping. Like anybody, they love to buy things. And so when they're, when they have a long, slow weekend, they love to get out and walk about in big sunglasses and baseball caps.
If they're all around us, celebrities, and they are in New York, how do we make sure that we recognize them when they're disguised behind the cap and the dark sunglasses?
Oh, well, I mean, basically, most celebrities are women, so you can easily cut off half the human race that way. And then the other way to do it is look for unnaturally skinny women with lots and lots of accessories.
But there are lots of women in Manhattan who are over-accessorized and underfed.
Yes, that's true, but when you're in Soho on a sunny afternoon, it's worth checking twice. In other parts of the city, it doesn't matter.
Lawrence Lussier is right now in the Meatpacking District waiting for Christina Aguilera to show up. Lawrence, thank you for being a part of the conversation.
I appreciate it. It's very fun.
That's all the time we have for the conversation tonight. Our program is produced by Ilya Meritz, Allison Lichter, Sujani Reddy, and Lindley Smith. Our engineer is Kevin Bristow, and our webmaster is Mark Phillips. Our executive producer is Nuala McGovern. I'm David Cruz. Join us again tomorrow at 8 when the conversation continues on WNYC AM 820 and WNYC.org. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this limited series from WNYC, New York Public Radio. WNYC has a wide range of podcasts, and you can find them at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is all made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.